This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Michael Caine has made over 70 films in 30 years. He first established himself as a playboy in Alfie and as a crook turned secret agent in The Ipcress File. More recently, he won an Academy Award for Hannah and Her Sisters and starred in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Mona Lisa, Educating Rita, and Dressed to Kill. Of course, some of his 70 films were stinkers, like The Swarm, Jaws the Revenge, and Beyond the Poseidon Adventure. In his recent autobiography, What's It All About?, he tells his story from his birth in the charity ward of a hospital to his coming of age in a working-class neighborhood and his rise as a movie star. I spoke with him a year ago when the book was published. Caine has said that an actor's eyes are his most important asset. His voice is the second most important asset. Caine has one of the most distinctive voices in film.
Having a Cockney accent for a start was difficult, but also it's where the voice was placed. Cockneys naturally talk. I'll try and get up there. It's right up in the throat here. It's rather like John Major, our Prime Minister. He talks like that, and the trick was to bring my voice down to the diaphragm. If you could imagine, if it's right up here in the throat, and then they bring it down a little bit further, like another one of our politicians who talks like that, and it's rather strangulated. But if you're going to boom out in the theatre without deafening the people at the front, you've got to be able to project your voice. And that was the most important thing that ever happened to me with my voice, which was it was placed. And the second thing was that over a period of years, I never went to the normal diction lessons that you had. British actors always spoke terribly like that, and they all spoke exactly the same because they all learned how to speak at RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. And what happened to me is I worked on my own because I was never a trained actor, and I worked on my own voice. So what happened was, as I came out of it with a voice that was correctly placed by accident and a very, very individual accent. My accent is so individual that people who don't recognize me by sight, the minute I open my mouth, they know who I am.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, did your Cockney accent stand in your way at all when you were first starting to make movies? Because England has a much more rigid class system in a way than America does, although we certainly have a class system here.
Yeah, well, you have a class system here, but you can't tell it by people's accents. In England, I can listen to a person and I'll tell you how much his house costs, how much he earns, what sort of car he drives after listening to him for 3 minutes. That's how defined by accent you are. Normally, in England, in the theatre when I came into it, there were no leading parts written for anybody in my natural accent. I always had to put on another accent. So in actual fact, from that point of view, it did hold me back a bit for a while.
Now, in the movie Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which was made just a few years ago in the States, you and Steve Martin starred, and you were this really kind of upper-class, elegant womanizer who who came onto wealthy women and scammed them and took their money, whereas Steve Martin was a real kind of nickel-and-dime scam artist out for the same thing, wealthy women, and you taught him how to really do the more aristocratic version of it. What kind of accent did you use for that?
Well, that would be the British upper-middle-class accent. It was always the people, the upper-middle-class usually have the pretensions of the aristocrat without the class and also the pretensions of the rich without the money. And so what you get is someone with absolutely no substance who is all front. And so you get a voice which is terribly like that, and it's very smooth and very, very slow.
My guest is actor Michael Caine. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Actor Michael Caine is my guest. Now, another great role that I have to ask you about your voice in was in Mona Lisa, in which you played a crime boss, a gangster.
Who
Bob Hoskins played somebody who is kind of under you in there, and you were really intimidating him in your scenes in the film. It's a fantastic performance by you. Can you talk about how you used your voice in that? Because you needed to use it in a way that showed real authority and the willingness to intimidate and, if necessary, hurt somebody.
Yeah, authority is shown not only by voice but by movement. And what it is, first thing in authority is you never move. Only people who are trying to attract your attention with no power move their hands. If you look at aristocracy and really powerful people, they move very little because everybody is awaiting their every word, wish, or command, and their voice is very, very slow because everybody will wait while they have their thought and wait no matter how long it takes for them to say what they're going to say. What you have to add in this case where I played a gangster, which would be menace, and menace would come if you were, I had a gangster accent, which is again a working class Cockney accent, but there is a sort of cheerful, chirpy working class sort of, hello lads, let's all go down the pub and all this, you know, that sort of accent for the chirpy Cockney lad, cheerful little soul. But then there's another one, which is, it's kind of very drawn out, and it's very flat. And so they will actually say things to you. I grew up with gangsters like this, and they will say, I like you. And there's absolutely no emotion in the voice whatsoever. It's like an icicle. You know, they say, I think you're one of the nicest fellas I've ever met. Really do. I really think you're very nice. So, and then they say silly little things. When you know you're in trouble with a Cockney gangster, he'll say something like, well, who's been naughty then? Now, that question means you're probably going to get kneecapped to the floor. But it's one of those things of just flattening the voice out. The voice just flattens right out, no matter what you say. It just flattens.
Now, when you say you're in a position of power and authority, you don't move a lot.
No.
That means you don't blink a lot, too.
No. Oh, that's a trick for actors on film that I used and it was told. I think the first place I heard it was Marlene Dietrich who said it first, is that you don't blink. If you blink on camera, it signifies weakness. It's very difficult to do this trick on radio about blinking. But if you look in the mirror yourself, and just stare and start saying things to yourself, you'll see how powerful it is. And if you just blink once in the middle of it, you'll see how it all dissipates. It just dissipates the whole thing. And of course, if you're on a movie screen, you have to remember when you blink, each eyelid is somewhere between 2 to 7 feet wide. If you're in a close up.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Well, how do you learn to not blink? It's hard to not blink. Your eyes start to hurt. You can do it for a little bit, but after a while, it's a real strain.
You just walk around. I walked around all my life. When I was a young lad, I wrote this about this in the book. When I was a young lad, I found a book in the public library, How to Teach Yourself Film Acting. And the first thing it said in it is, you must not blink. And so I walked around. I walked around this sort of working class district of London, which was used to some very rough people, you know, without blinking. And I looked like a sort of early serial killer. I'm sure I frightened the life out of people because I used to have long conversations with people and never blink. And I would watch people getting hypnotized. and they would walk away from a quite simple conversation with me, quite flummoxed as to what went on.
Well, here's what I'm wondering, you know, since you learned, obviously, by making movies, how did you pick up everything that you know now about how to look into a camera or how, like, where to look when the camera's looking at you? Did you pick that up over years after watching yourself?
No, I never watch myself. I never see rushes, and I only see the finished film once just to see how it turned out and who goofed, including me. And, it's... Film is... listening, reaction, and behavior. That's what film acting is. It shouldn't be called film acting at all because it's not acting. It's something entirely... Acting is what you do on stage, as far as I'm concerned. And people behave. The only time real people act is if they're showing off or trying to make an impression, like a guy with a girl or something. Then they act, and then they're artificial, and we can all see they're artificial because they're acting. But normally, what you do is you listen... and you react, and then you behave, and that's all it is. You'll see actors, like, for instance, making gestures on the phone with no one there. You don't make gestures on the phone with no one there. You think you do, but you don't. And so you get sort of strange things happening like that when you see actors acting.
Mm-hmm. Now, but what about where to look when the camera's looking at you? I mean, you really learned how to work
Yes.
in front of a camera. And if you didn't spend a lot of time watching yourself, how did you learn that?
No, well, I learned by watching where the camera was. I mean, for instance, you always, if you're going to, the thing is, if you're going to play a part, you're playing a part with another actor, and you look in their eyes. And what you do, if you're acting, you suddenly go, well, how do I look into this person's eyes? Now, during your lifetime, you've looked into hundreds of people's eyes every time you speak to someone, but you can't remember how you did it. And what you do is you only look into one eye, because if you look into two eyes, you go cross-eyed. And the one eye you look into is the one that is nearest the camera, because that throws the one eye that you're not looking in, not using, straight into the lens.
Huh.
That's how you do that.
Now, how'd you learn that?
I figured it out. How to do it. I figured it out myself, actually. I figured out a lot of stuff myself, because you get a feeling in movies when you play someone. The actor should disappear and people should only see the person. I mean, it's a self-defeating thing in a funny way, because half the time people see me and they say, well, he's only playing himself. It's because I've made the actor disappear. And that's where you come down to this thing where you've got behavior and where you've got the camera. You can come down to the absolute minimum thing to do for the camera to pick up. And that's what's fascinating about film acting, because camera always finds it.
Michael Caine is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography called What's It All About? You were born, actually, not only working class, it was a really pretty poor family. You were born in the charity ward of the hospital. Your father was a porter at the fish market, your mother a cleaning woman. You spent several years in an apartment that had no electricity.
I never lived in a house that had electricity until I was 12 years old,
mm-hmm.
which was in 1948.
So what did your friends think of your ambition to act?
Oh, they thought it was complete and utter, completely ridiculous, utterly derisory. I was just treated with absolute contempt by everybody, or ridicule.
Now, why ridicule? I mean,
because, well, for a start, people of my class and in that society never went into show business. No one knew anybody who was in show business or anything. And also, like, my family, the male members of my family would regard any male going into show business or acting as being homosexual anyway, or a possible homosexual. There was a tremendous gay inference. I mean, we didn't use the word gay in those days. If you said, when I said to my father I was going to be an actor, it was the equivalent of telling him I was homosexual as far as he was concerned.
So did you feel that you had to do things to prove your manhood while studying acting?
No, I was already doing those, but my father didn't know about it.
I think I get what you're saying.
Yes. But I really had to prove to him. I married very young, which I sometimes think was an effort to prove to him that I wasn't gay. And I had a child when I was 22. I had a daughter when I was 22, and of course, with his simple-minded way of looking at it, he was again wrong, because the fact that I was married and had a baby meant to him that I was definitely not a homosexual, and so he was wrong in both cases, you know, because there are a lot of people who are married with children who are homosexuals, but he had a very simplistic view of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a very, very tough man. I mean, and it's very hard to put across to anybody, to get across to anybody just how tough he was. Back again to the gay analogy, he actually thought that any man who ate chicken was gay.
Chicken?
Yes.
Why?
Because this red meat thing, you know, real men ate red meat and all this stuff. And And he thought that was sissy food, chicken.
Did he ever come see you in a performance or see your movies?
No. No, he died. He died when I was completely out of work, completely broke. He died of cancer when he was 56 years old. So he never. One of my great regrets in my life is that his last memories of me was as a complete and utter disaster and failure. But at least he knew I wasn't gay because I had a wife and a child.
Right. Michael Caine recorded 1 year ago. His memoir, What's It All About, will be published in paperback in January. This is Fresh Air.